Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
BBC.
You're with the BBC, also podcasting via bbcworldservice.com.
Hello and welcome along to our weekly World Technology Show. I'm Gareth Mitchell and this is Digital Planet. Today, mesh networks on the move with some video conferencing between two cars.
So there's another car about 100 metres behind us.
Yeah.
And they've got all this equipment in as well. So yeah, we're trying to call them.
Yeah, looks like they're not picking up.
That was the driver in the background resorting to walkie-talkies to make that work. Stay tuned to hear if we actually did manage to video conference between vehicles in the end. Plus, we couldn't resist letting some marketing types on this week. I mean, who wouldn't? With a slogan like this.
It is, as you know, really, really small. But I think its impact and the potential it has will be really, really big.
The technology that they say is sweeping the laptop to one side. All that and more, it's right here on Digital Planet from the BBC. But, you know, it's a strange world we live in, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, everyone wants to be famous these days. I mean, you look at the various Big Brother TV shows around the world. They're never short of applicants who are very keen to have their every waking and indeed sleeping moments displayed to millions of people. The British Big Brother started again just last week. And yet, we're also the first to complain if we fear that we're being spied upon by the state or by big business. And as soon as people actually become famous, then they get very cross with the media for prying into their private lives. And why is it that the rest of us jealously guard things like our PIN number, whilst also willfully spilling out all kinds of personal information about ourselves on social networking sites? Well, these were all issues that set the scene for a meeting in London last week. It was called Social Networking, Privacy and the Press. It was hosted by the Westminster Media Forum, which is a body that regularly brings together British policymakers with experts in media and online. One of those experts was Adrian Monk. He's Professor of Journalism at City University in London. He joins me live. So thanks for coming along, Adrian. What did you bring to this meeting?
Probably a healthy cynicism about the data that people give away about themselves. My background is in investigative journalism, and I've always been very careful about the kind of information I've passed on about myself. But it never ceases to amaze me how much info people will share, the kind of info that lets you guess their banking passwords, their dog's name, their birthday,
mother's maiden name, all these things.
All out there. And, you know, people are very much unaware that this information is going into kind of the public domain.
And the cynicism you bring to it is from having been an investigative journalist. So you know what journos are like. And I guess you also know the kind of risks that people might face if they post up a load of pictures on their Facebook profile, and a whole load of journalists or other people can be helping themselves to them these days.
Absolutely. And there's countless cases, both of celebrities and private individuals, who suddenly find themselves in the middle of a big story where people are helping themselves to material online and very much forgetting about any issues you might have thought of copyright or personal protection. And this is increasingly an issue that faces us, not just in the UK, but transnationally. These are transnational platforms. You can be involved in a tsunami in the Far East and then find that you're hit back home because your Facebook profile reveals you're a cross-dresser and you've been involved in this awful, tragic event. I mean, people just don't realise how much information there is out there about themselves and how it can be used.
I know, because people get really excited, don't they, posting all this stuff up about themselves, lots of images and videos. If this person then suddenly becomes the news, then those images, that content, has a real currency amongst journalists and media organisations.
It's not just that. In fact, there's increasing amounts of people discovering that when they Google themselves, perhaps a comment they might have left 5 years ago, 6 years ago on a website, you're finding teenagers who maybe left remarks about legalizing cannabis, discovering that when you come to Google them, this is the top entry under their name. Mm. And there's all kinds of information, digital information people are leaving out there that's actually going to follow them around for the rest of their lives.
I know, these people are going to become politicians. That's going to be really interesting, you know, when the youth of today, the politicians of tomorrow, journalists like us are going to have a field day if we're still in the business. Bill Thompson's also here in the studio with us. He joins us every week as our studio expert. And Bill, I mean, your mind operates on many levels, on very high levels, but also you've been spotting the celebs, haven't you, in social networking sites?
I have, because it seems that Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan, among others, have found that the pictures they've loaded onto MySpace that they thought were private, in fact, weren't as private as they thought, because of security problems with these sites and the way they interact. And I think, as well as the stuff that people are putting up publicly, as Adrian was saying, there's also the material we put up with an expectation that it will remain private. But in fact, anything you publish on the internet, you really should assume could be found by someone and may be exposed inadvertently. And I think this needs to feed into any regulation, any policy making, any discussion of these issues. It's not just people revealing information about themselves deliberately, it's also the inadvertent revelations.
And I suppose also, Adrian, we become publishers in our own right on these social networking sites, don't we?
We do. I mean, I think people have just caught up with the fact that emails can be passed on with one click, and email's been around for, you know, 10, 15 years now. And I think they're just starting to understand that actually Facebook friends and other such details are giving other people the opportunity to do the same thing for them. But there's more to it than that even, because we're becoming publishers of other people's details. And if you don't want your children put up on your website online, too bad if your friends are less picky, and that when their kids come to play and they take photos, you know, they post the photos up, they post your kids' identities up online. These are all the kinds of issues that we're facing.
Well, I mean, there was a video of me on Facebook that was tagged by Gareth without my permission, without even asking me, saying I was in it. And then everyone can find me. So this sort of thing happens all the time.
Yeah, sorry about that, Bill. Keep you anonymous from now on. But what conclusions can we draw apart from reprimanding people who used to put your videos up with and tagging them without permission? Should we all just retreat? Say, I just don't want to be online anymore. The risks are too great. Why should I bother?
Well, I don't think we can retreat. I think that the questions that come out of all this are questions about educating people about what the responsibilities are online, but it's also about ownership. I mean, 150, 200 years ago, copyright in its infancy, you know, people genuinely didn't understand that reproducing work was something that affected the author. And now we're very much coming to understand, only in the last 2 to 3 years even, that we're the author of our own data and of information about ourselves, and that we ought to maybe have some ownership rights over that information. And I think that's going to be a battle we'll be seeing in the next 10 to 15 years.
OK, well, thanks for that, Adrian. I might just try and be one of your friends on Facebook and check out your pictures, but only with your permission. Thanks for coming in, and more from Bill in a few moments. But we're going to talk about wireless now. It's a technology that's so ubiquitous that we'd probably lose a good 25% of story ideas for this programme if we never talked about it. First, of course, it was a way of connecting your laptop to the net when you're out and about. But now it's increasingly the technology of choice for any device or gadget that you might previously have connected with an old-fashioned cable. But wireless could soon become pointless without the all-important technical standards to keep all those bits and pieces in tune with each other. Now, one such standard is called Zigbee, and it's particularly aimed at smaller devices. The standard actually dates back to 2004, but now one firm that manufactures a wireless-based intruder alarm system is claiming to have become the first to build its whole product around Zigbee. The company is called AlertMe, and our reporter Anna Lacey has been speaking to the chief technologist there, Laura James.
AlertMe is a new way of keeping you in touch with your home wherever you are. So we use a network of wireless sensors throughout your home to monitor for important things like intruders or fire. And they connect to a hub which plugs into your broadband router. And that hub talks up to AlertMe's secure servers over the internet. And then our servers get in touch with you via text message or email.
Okay, so you've got some of the sensors here in your hands. Can you just describe what they all do?
Well, all our sensors are small white boxes, so we have a motion sensor and also a door window sensor that tells you if things are open or closed. We also have an alarm detector, which listens out for the sound of your existing smoke alarm or carbon monoxide alarm and networks it to AlertMe. And we also have key fobs, which are small devices that you put on your keyring, take them with you, and use those to control the system, just like blipping a car alarm. You blip one button when you come home and one button when you go out.
Please exit. AlertMe will be set to away from home.
Well, we're actually here in AlertMe HQ now, here in Cambridge, and we've set up the system so we can see exactly how it works. And now I'm going to be the unexpected intruder that's coming into the home. So we've got one of the door sensors armed. I'm going to open the door.
An intruder sensor has been triggered. The intruder alarm will sound. To cancel this, click the big button on a key fob.
Obviously, I don't have a key fob, so what will happen next?
Well, the system gives you a short interval in case you did have a key fob and were just someone coming home and forgotten to blip, and then the alarm will go off. And it'll send out alerts via text message and email to whoever's configured to get alerts.
Alert Me has contacted the homeowner.
Now, looking a bit closer at the technology, what we've got here is this central hub that is a small cube about, 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres. How is that communicating with these sensors around the home?
So the wireless network in the home uses a new technology called Zigbee, which is a radio network designed for small battery-powered sensors and control devices. And Zigbee is quite a new technology. Alert Me is actually the first certified consumer product using Zigbee, but we think you're going to see a lot more of it in the next couple of years.
So how is this Zigbee system different from other wireless systems people might have used, such as with laptops or Bluetooth on your mobile phone?
Zigbee, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth all use the same 2.4 gigahertz radio band, so it's sort of familiar from that point of view. But in other ways, it's very different. Zigbee's designed for simple sensor and control devices, and it runs on a very low bit rate, so it doesn't carry very much data, and very low power, so a battery in an Alert Me device will last 2 to 3 years. And it's specially designed to carry these sort of signals. It's very quick, data gets from A to B straight away, but there's not that much data. It's just a little bit of sensor information, like whether your door's open, what the temperature is, that kind of thing.
And of course, you're using this network at the moment for home security, but do you think that using Zigbee technology could be expanded somewhat and used for other applications?
Definitely. And one space where we've seen a lot of growth in the last year is in energy. So there are now smart meters, simple gas or electricity meters, being replaced by more intelligent ones that can help the user see what their usage is. And they're starting to use Zigbee around the world as well. Zigbee is an open standard, so anyone can build a Zigbee system. And we'll be keen to do technology partnerships with companies with specialisms in other areas, such as automatic plant watering or energy efficiency or whatever's next.
Such a great name for a standard, isn't it? Zigbee. That was Laura James talking to Anna Lacey. So, Bill Thompson, you've actually tried this out, haven't you?
I have. They were kind enough to lend me one of their systems for a month, so I put it into my house and had the burglar alarms going off when I left the house. And it was really interesting, partly because, as well as having the Zigbee-based technology in the house, it plugs into your broadband internet connection, and you actually control and monitor it through a web interface, which you can do remotely. So I took great pleasure in turning on the burglar alarm while my son was at home. And as he moved, suddenly this thing went off. And that, he really liked that.
Oh, yes. The response to that must have been unbroadcastable, Bill. So apart from giving you lots of ways of tormenting your poor son, it does seem like a really good demonstration of being able to get lots of devices and get them all talking to each other and to a central hub and online using this kind of wireless format.
I think it is. I mean, in a sense, Alert Me is a good technology demonstration of what low-power, sort of reliable wireless networking could do around the house. And although they're selling it as a burglar alarm system, that's where sneaking a home automation system in. And it will be, for me, the exciting thing will be when they do start these technology partnerships and you get more ideas being fed into the company for different sorts of devices like energy monitoring and things like that. So although Alert Me is interesting, I think it's the potential that I'm really looking forward to. It's what they do next.
Yeah, exactly. I think if it was in mine, I'd probably turn my house into the Big Brother house, although the viewing would not be that good, I have to say. All right, this is Digital Planet. We're on air, online and podcasting, moving swiftly on here at the BBC World Service in London. I'm Gareth Mitchell. And still to come, the end of the laptop as we know it. But we're going to carry on talking about wireless now, because researchers at the University of California in Los Angeles have decided that on the road, wireless should extend beyond just the car radio. So they've equipped some of the campus service vehicles with wireless-enabled laptops that link together between cars to form a mesh network on the move. It allows web connectivity, video conferencing, and the opportunity to map each vehicle's whereabouts in real time on an interactive map. One of the project leaders is Giovanni Pau. He's a research scientist in the Department of Computer Science at UCLA's Henry Samueli School of Engineering and Applied Science. Well, for a demo, we set off on a trip around the sprawling and very scenic UCLA campus. We were in the lead vehicle, which was bristling with antennas and sensors. And in the back seat, armed with his laptop, Giovanni told me more about the gear involved.
Well, we have a computer and we have a GPS, we have a wireless LAN that connects the car, and basically we have a dynamic protocol that allows us to reconfigure the network automatically and seamlessly while the car moves each other, so they can get disconnected and reconnected and they can change the topology and the user will never notice that.
With the wireless then, is that connecting you to the wider internet, or are you just using the wireless technology for these different cars to be able to communicate with each other?
basically we are using the wireless technology to connect the car to each other. And then the leading car, that is the one where we are, is connected through the internet using a 3G wireless technology. So basically this car is allowing everybody else to connect to the internet. And that's probably what can be a vision of the future. You have still a few cars that can offer advanced service to others and allow other cars to go to the internet.
It's a really nice combination of technologies here then. So we're getting connected to the wider internet through mobile 3G. So that's coming into one of these
laptops
here. And then that internet can be relayed to the other cars. Let's talk through what's on the screen then. Two laptops. First of all, the one on the right has what is very obviously a Google map that's showing the UCLA campus here. So what's going on here?
We used the Google map technology. We do the mashup. And we are plotting on the Google map our position and the links across cars. We can be plotting, for example, the amount of carbon dioxide that the cars are sensing around, or the pictures of the cars that are around us.
What it's showing is that you can take real-time data and mash that up with the Google Maps.
Exactly. Most people know that the car now is basically mainly electronics. Inside your car, you have sensors everywhere. So theoretically, you can plot the information from the sensor of the car behind you or in front of you and understand what type of driver you have in front or behind you. And so somewhat forecast what will be his reaction or her reaction at any possible stimulus from the street.
And the really exciting thing is that anything you need to know about any of these vehicles could, in theory, be put onto this map. Anything about what the performance of the engines, environmental sensors on the cars, that kind of thing.
Any type of information from sensors on the car, on sensors on the environment, or cameras. For example, one application that is envisioned by U.S. Police Department is to have cameras that take snapshots from the streets, cameras, for example, from buses or police cars, and then you can elaborate this snapshot, you can process this snapshot offline and find some strange things that happen in the city and trying to understand if there are crime actions offline after the fact, and basically use as a forensic way to prove something.
Effectively, you have an office on the move here, really, don't you? So can you do kind of office-related things or video conferencing things with all this stuff?
Yes, we can do a video conference. We can do, of course, writing emails, getting emails, all type of regular day-by-day information. Indeed.
Yeah, obviously for the passengers. You haven't got the technology so far that you can do this whilst you're driving,
exactly,
obviously.
Exactly. You cannot call the drivers.
This looks familiar. You have a voice over IP application here.
Yeah.
Other brands are available, but this is Skype.
Yeah,
so you're making a Skype call.
I'm making a Skype call.
There it goes. It's calling up. Who are you calling here?
I'm calling one of the two cars back. I don't even know which one.
Okay. So there's another car about 100 metres behind us.
Yeah.
And they've got all this equipment in as well. So we're trying to call them.
Yeah. Looks like they're not picking up.
Pick up.
That's why walkie-talkies were invented.
Yeah.
We are calling you. Okay, wait. Running now, call.
Okay, we got it. Hey, Ronnie.
Yeah.
Okay, you are on the call. Let's see if you can see, you can see me.
Right, we're setting this up for video conference now. Here we go. The computer's just thinking about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, fantastic. I can see this other guy is on camera. He's in one of the cars just about 100 metres away.
Yeah.
And he's just repositioning his webcam so we can see him properly.
Yeah.
Slightly wobbly, but he's stabilised the camera. And there he is. We can see the car in the background. And there's us in the bottom left-hand corner of the window, as you'd expect from a video conference. He can see us. We can see him.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, this is a video conference going on between one car and the other. And basically, probably we are using the car in the middle. We have a car between us and them as a relay car. And the guy that is driving the car in the middle doesn't even know about it.
There you go. That's Giovanni Pau. And we would have played you some of my video conference with that chap in the other car. But to be honest, I got all tongue-tied. I didn't quite know what to do. And I sort of appeared on camera and he was in the other car. We just looked at each other and said, oh, good, the technology works then, doesn't it? And then went home. But fascinating stuff anyway. Well, we're finishing in Taiwan this week. It's just held its annual high-tech showcase, Computex. It's the largest event of its kind in Asia and the big story there? Small PCs. Because over the last year or so, one or two scaled down cheap PCs, which are somewhere in size between, say, a PDA and a laptop, have been hitting the market. Running the open source operating system Linux, they've done really well in emerging economies, as you might expect, but they've also sold incredibly keenly in the richer countries, which suggests that many consumers seem to be very happy to trade multiple features and computing power for nice, neat little web-enabled devices that are portable and, above all, affordable. Caroline Gluck was in Taipei for us to report on how this trend for so-called sub-notebooks or netbooks was reflected at that Computex event. Now, the BBC at this point would like to warn you that some listeners may be disturbed by the rather appalling quality of the rap music in the following item.
It's by my side, you can chat with friends. It's easy to use, you can use the things.
Giant chipmaker Intel has been making a big song and dance about its new tiny low-powered microprocessor, the Atom. It unveiled a lineup of low-cost small computers featuring the chip, which it's calling netbooks, 90% of them designed by Taiwanese companies. Navin Shenoy, Intel's Asia-Pacific vice president, said the chip was revolutionary.
It is, as you know, really, really small, but I think its impact and the potential it has will be really, really big. But most importantly, these devices, these netbooks, are being designed to bring the power of the internet to almost everyone. And the way you do that is you reach lower price points.
I love to travel on all kinds of different journeys. The simple and lightweight EPC gives me total freedom wherever I go.
Among the new products are the latest designs of low-cost EPCs from Asus Tech. The company's first model caused a sensation when it was launched last year. Weighing less than a kilo with a 7-inch screen, it cost as little as $300. The latest designs have larger screens and more features, including models with a battery life of more than 7 hours. CEO Jerry Shen says the concept has opened a new market in the industry.
Many, many of the people use the EPC as the second PC. And also for the emerging country, a lot of people, they cannot afford to buy the computers. So EPC support is kind of affordable price to those people to narrow the digital divide.
Gloria is on a backpacking holiday in the south of France. With her Aspire 1 featuring both instant Wi-Fi and WAN capability, Gloria can travel with confidence.
Playing catch-up, Taiwan's top computer brand Acer launched its first portable internet device, a mini laptop called the Aspire 1. With a 9-inch screen, it can run on the latest Linux operating system, reducing the time users have to wait to power up and down the computer. Company chairman J.T. Wong thinks the smaller, lower-cost notebooks will revitalize overall industry growth.
Instant access to the internet with a full internet experience.
We expect that this new segment is going to grow to occupy more than 20% of the total notebook market. I strongly believe within a short period of time, this segment will exceed more than 50 million pieces per year and even go further.
As you can see, the Vera OpenBook sports a very stylish and sleek design that weighs less than a kilo and is very easy.
At the show, another Taiwanese chip maker, Vera Technologies, was showing off its new OpenBook, an open source reference design allowing brand name partners to integrate almost anything into the system. Vera's marketing manager, Timothy Brown, says it can support all types of operating systems and different wireless platforms.
This is ideal for video.
We've tried to open up the design part of it so that people can actually change the look and feel a little bit more themselves cheaply. They can download for free the open source CAD files and provide those to whoever it is that's manufacturing their product and have them design it how they want it.
Almost every major computer company is looking to develop new ranges of small, ultra-portable wireless PCs. There's a strong emphasis on stylish, light and slim designs, since they're highly visible items for people on the go. but they're also cheap enough so that customers don't have to think too hard about buying a laptop. And that could help open up the market to more first-time buyers, jump-starting sales at a time when the global economy is starting to slow down.
That's Caroline Gluck reporting from Taiwan. So I speak as somebody who's just spent quite a lot of money on a fairly high-end computer, laptop. Bill speaks as somebody who's done something quite different.
And I'm clutching my blue Asus EPC even as I speak now. It's a lovely little device, so good that my son actually stole it from me, probably revenge for the burglar alarm trick, as soon as it came into the house and uses a writing machine. These are fascinating devices. It was an unexpected marketplace. And to some extent, the one laptop per child, the OLPC XL1, made people realise there was scope for these, what seem to be stripped-down devices, but are, thanks to the speed of today's computer chips, actually significantly powerful machines, that there was a market for them, people would want them. And now it's just exploding. Every manufacturer seems to want one of these, you know, sub-notebook, netbook, whatever they call them, and I think they're going to sell in their tens of millions.
And I guess Microsoft is thinking they're going to sell in their tens of millions as well. So is it putting Windows on these devices?
It is. They're working hard at that. It's quite interesting because this one comes with a version of Linux called Zandros, but Ubuntu Linux, which is very popular, will also run on it perfectly happily. The latest ones, that models from Asus, will run Windows, but it's XP. It's not Vista, because XP doesn't require as much in terms of computer power. And Microsoft is sort of extending the lifetime of XP precisely because this market is out here. They couldn't just cede the space to Linux. They couldn't just leave it. That would have been a very foolish thing to do. So in fact, we're going to see versions of Windows to run on these machines, and yet it will compete much more directly, perhaps, than people would have expected.
And maybe competing with smartphones as well in the week that Steve Jobs is bringing out the iPhone version 2.
Well, that's it. The smartphones are moving up and the laptops are moving down, and we don't yet know what's going to happen in the middle or what sort of devices or multiple devices we'll be using in 5 years' time.
OK, well, Bill Thompson, thank you very much indeed for that. That is it for this week. You can find us on Facebook, although I say that rather hesitantly after the discussion before. The producer today has been Julian Birthday Boy Siddle, and also Colin Grant's helped out too. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.